You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagelessepodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's bastienhughes.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes. The first five people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to bastienhughes.com, because many, many times we can get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we've created and then just think, well, what's next? What now? Well, bastienhughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
Unashamedly be who you are, you know, like fold to no one, give no one anything more than you haven't got, because that'll fuck it up. The hard part is working out what you are, and when you know that, like, I'm obviously not in the best state, like, but I know what I am, and I know I can survive, and I can write great music. You have to find the thing that no one else can do like you can do. It's all about you, your story. Even if people don't give a shit, it has to be about what you can do and how you're different from everyone else, and that will seriously change your life, you know, I believe, you know.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestagelessepodcast.com for all episodes featuring Steve Cropper, Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, as well as members of Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Oasis, Madness, The 1975, and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording, and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis Presley and David Bowie. Described by Ian Brody as one of the most unique guitarists he's ever seen, today we're joined by one of the greatest songsmiths of his generation, Bill Ryder-Jones, who, after being a founding member of the Coral, has released four beautiful and critically acclaimed solo albums, as well as producing the likes of Hooton Tennis Club and, of course, recording and being stage left to Arctic Monkeys for their AM record. With that in mind, we'll be discussing Bill's songwriting process and learning what advice Bill would give to young musicians as to what support they could best offer to a fellow bandmate who's going through a personally challenging time. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Bill Ryder-Jones. Thanks for joining today, Bill. How's it going?
Thanks very much for that. That was a very warm intro. You put my name in with a lot of big hitters there. I feel like, are you scraping the bottom of the barrel? Is that what have you?
Did you know the excitement around this episode when I announced this episode is coming out? There's a lot of people who have got a lot of time for you, man. It's, you know, I'm really, really looking forward to exploring some of your stuff. Actually, a recent Instagram post that you did, you said that you were doing a song that had Terminator 2 vibes. Now, my top three films of all time, number one is a film called Old Boy, which is a Korean film. Number two is Life is Beautiful, which is an Italian film. And number three, Terminator 2, Judgment Day. So, Bill Ryder-Jones, what does Terminator 2 mean to you?
It was a bit of a shot at myself. Like, so one of my best friends lives below me and they had a kid, and when my mates have kids, if I've got the time, I write a lullaby for a kid and then I score it and, like, you know, frame it and give them a CD, you know, to play to the kid. And that song we call Music for Luna, so that's Luna downstairs. It just so happened that I was on my laptop, I don't have all my best samples, so the synths were a little bit Terminator sounding rather than the kind of lush, expensive samples that I use when I'm getting paid, I guess, you know. So that was the Terminator connection. The film itself, I mean, other than the fact that John Connor was, like, kind of the idol of my generation, you know, like that. He inhibited a lot of that apathy and that, you know, that we all kind of, those of us who didn't have a truly brilliant band to grow up with, he was that, I guess. So that, yeah, that's my relationship with Terminator. It's a good film, like, you know, but it's a bit silly, isn't it, you know. Well, it's your third favourite film, but
my third favourite film. It's devastating to hear you say that.
The films are silly, aren't they? They're just like, it's like 2 hours of just fucking nonsense with some decent music, and like, the problem with films is unless it's made by one person or two people who are in charge completely, you can watch most films, and it's like listening to like, as much as I love Beyonce, it's like listening to a Beyonce record where you're like, well, she's incredible, but you know there were 8 people involved,
yep,
getting their hands in, and that for me is not, well, it's new art, but it's not a personal, the personal connection that I particularly want. I want writer to talk to me without having a team, you know. But
so when you've written film scores, right, for a number of films, and have you ever written a piece of music that has reinterpreted a scene in a way that a director didn't want you to do it in that particular way?
No, I just mean, like, people say I write films. I've done like 2. It was when I 2008 when I signed to Domino. The whole thing was like, yeah, I'm done with, like, in the morning and like guitar things, and I wanted to. You know, I was a child of 32 and wanted to be a film composer because you get to say it, sit at home and do nothing, you know, and just, but no, I don't do them. I wish my career in that sense had taken off, but I just didn't get the work, so I started making records, you know.
And they're very good. Can you remember the name of the very first song you ever wrote? And what were you trying to convey in that very first song?
Well, I'm not going to tell you the first song because we're not doing that. But the first good song, the first good song I ever wrote was called "The Devil Looks Over Lincoln," and it was about Parker's Peace in Cambridge. Don't know if you know. I lived in Cambridge. I was engaged very young, and I lived in Cambridge when I left the band the first time. And I used to score weed and Parker's Peace, and there was a lot of heroin addicts, and it was like, yeah, it's a beautiful place, but it's quite dark. And that was the first good song I've ever written. I don't think there's a version of it. A lot of my early songs, a lot of my early demos made it onto YouTube. Some lovely person put them up, but I don't think that's there. But I mean, it's essentially just like a real Nick Drake kind of rip off, you know. It's not It's not something I'd revisit or challenge with having any scope, you know.
Interesting. I mean, we're going to dip into like your creative process later on, if you're happy to share. I know something you did recently though was for Michael Price song "In Spite of the Weather." That was, it is reimagined by you. Tell us about that process. Were you kind of given the remit to be as creative as you like on that, or did Michael give you a very kind of specific thing that he wanted you to contribute?
No, like, I'm a huge fan of Michael Price's writing. Like, and then they got in touch and said, do you want to reimagine this song? And they had some quite big hitters on that project. Jan Tiersen was involved, and he took the best song, and I were left with something that was beautiful, but I didn't think was Michael's best work. So I took maybe 2 or 3 bars of this little piano thing and thought, oh, well, I'm not talented enough to, like, I had to just take a couple of notes, a couple of chords, and then just go, well, I'm Bill and I'll do Bill. And it's one of my favourite songs I've ever written. It's absolutely, I'm talking to them now because I want it on my record, but I think there's a legal issue with the fact that I wrote a whole song based on 4 notes, and for some reason it's not okay for me to have that thing that I wrote. But but I love that song. I thought that was beautiful. It's one of the songs that, like, see, it's like I'm dead open about loads of things, but there's certain things that I'm so embarrassed, like my agoraphobia, like, and feeling so pathetic. I very rarely write about, I'll romanticise the bad shit. But with that song, I thought I did a really good job about someone of my age who's, like, I mean, I just got a text this morning off in my best mate's group chat. Another one of them's just had a kid. And, you know, you're kind of at 38, looking at your life going, oh, I don't have kids, don't have a partner. And it kind of fucked me up. And then, but that song, I think, it's a nice way of saying, God, I'm just like another lonely person who wants someone who's going to be there. And yeah, I really love that piece of music. I'm really proud of that, you know. I listen to it quite a lot, actually.
I was listening to it nonstop yesterday, the second half of it, particularly like the outro towards the end. It's just such a compelling piece of music. And thank you for sharing that. We were born 2 weeks within each other. So you were born on the 10th of August and I was born on the 25th of August. You're just 15 days older than me. How do you feel like you're... You know, we would have been one of the youngest people in our year at school. How do you think that shaped you in any way? If you'd been born kind of 9 months older, do you think like it would have shaped you in any different way, being the youngest, kind of, often they say like the latest kind of developing their thinking, et cetera, in a year? Did that factor into any of your thinking? Because you must have been one of the youngest people in your year at school.
I was one of the youngest, but I mean, I didn't become who I am until several years after I left school. I know they're formative and they're important times, but I don't think being born 9 months later would have changed who I am. Life in school was... So you see, I live in this weird place where... So West Kirby's very upper middle class. We have two estates and we have quite a few rugby clubs. So we left primary school where everything was safe and lovely, and then all of a sudden you're dealing with kids who have had terrible upbringings, and then rugby, like, you know, genetic freak rugby lads. And that, I found that weird. The bully system I found very fucking weird. But it's like that, I don't know about you, like when you hit like your mid-20s, you look back on your school and you just think, like, fuck. It's such a tricky one. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Mm. Like, the way people treated you looking back. But it, obviously, at the time, it informs who you become. Yeah, so I don't like thinking about school. I found it quite a dark time, you know. And I don't know about you, but I got very little out of it, you know. Like, I got a GCSE in French, which has served me so well, and I learned trigonometry, and no prick taught me how to pay tax or, you know, or how to vote or any of the things that I find important. Yeah, school, I try not to think about a great deal, you know. I just think it was just gibberish, you know. Just like, there's no... See, I was flagged as, like, a trouble case, so I had a lot of... Because of the death of our Daniel, which I, at that point, didn't understand. I was just trying to get through without having the shit kicked out of me. So, yeah, I try not to think about school an awful lot. I think it can be very, very fucking traumatic for an adolescent, you know.
Sing God.
totally agree. And I think that, you know, you're touching upon an area there. I mean, obviously you touched upon Daniel there as well, that, you know, a lot of our experiences later on in life are shaped by, we're products of our upbringing and our surrounding. And you use the T word there, like trauma. Like, you know, you had a particularly traumatic, like a very, very traumatic childhood, and all the traumatic events happened in your childhood. And, you know, I wonder what there is, you know, how much that now shapes who we are as individuals. And I think there'll probably be a lot of people listening to this. You know, there's this idea that everyone actually has some kind of trauma, but how much of us actually process it? And there's a song lyric that you have in one of your songs, which says, "I keep you boxed in my unwanted memories. I keep you boxed in my unwanted memories." Is there something in that lyric about how us as humans process tragedy, or indeed we don't process it?
I mean, I love speaking to people like you, because songwriters pretend they don't want to, like, explain their lyrics. And then when someone pulls one out, the desire to be like, oh, this is who I am, this is what I mean. Yeah, I'm dead proud of that song in particular. I think they're probably my best words. But yeah, that was how I felt. I don't want him. I don't want him to be part of my life. I don't want to have witnessed his death. I don't want the repercussions of how it affected my mother and my father and me. But, you know, I'm an empath and I feel bad that he died, but I don't know the lad, you know. There's a hole. We were best friends for 7 years. He was my soulmate and I miss him a lot. Excuse me. Whew, hang on. It's fine, I'm not embarrassed. What was the question? Yeah, that's just a good line, you know. I keep your box. Yeah, I think all the lyrics for that song are very good. Yeah, it's one of the ones I'm most proud of, you know. I just wish I'd written a better chorus. I thought Daniel belongs to the ocean. I tried for weeks. This is how songwriting is. Like, the verses of that song happened in a minute, you know. Like, the first line, all the seal bound together, harnessing our ropes together, harnessing our loves together, the ropes were worn, they came undone. I think that's, you'd have that in Ted Hughes, you know, or John Donne, you know, you'd think that's fucking good. But then the craft of it, you kind of berate yourself for being a bit too on the nose at some point, you know. But he was a special kid. I wish I'd got to know him.
Thank you for sharing. And you know, you also said that in Wild Swans, you said, you know, there's an interesting few lines in Wild Swans which says, "When everything went wicked, I only wanted to be saved. There's this place I go, but you won't ever know. I find myself returning to there." Where is that place? And is it literal? Is it metaphorical? You know, where is your sanctuary that you go to when you feel you need to be saved?
In particular, well, specifically, that song was about an affair I had with quite an old woman, and I was with her because she was maternal, and it only lasted a couple of days. And then I realised that I was there because I wanted a mother. And where do I go to? Well, the song's about depression, and not just depression, but salvation, and also neuroses, you know, like the male need to be adored. So I used her as, like, so in the chorus, she's telling me, "It's not over till I say it's over." That's not me, you know, I'm not that guy, you know. If I'm with someone and they say it's over, then it's over. But that's another one of my favourite songs. I wish I could write like that. Now I can't write like that anymore. I don't know how it happened. Like, it were bad. But
why do you feel you can't write like that right now? What's changed?
I had no security. I was lost to the world now. So I'm battling drink and diazepam. So that keeps me safe. And it means I don't have... When I used to write songs before that, they were my diazepam, they were my alcohol, they were the things that kept me alive. like, you know, wild lemon trees in particular. Well, anything from Bad Wind. And if that was all before I found alcohol or diazepam. And that was how I got through the day. You know, like, there's something very spiritual about writing something clean and perfect. And that kept me going. And now I don't have that because I gave in a little bit, you know, to safety. You know, I've always just wanted to be safe and not scared. So now the way I write is a bit more thoughtful. They don't just come anymore. So I'll be honest, there's three songs on this new record that came. They just happened, and I think that's why a lot of artists, like good artists, do turn to drugs, because at some point in your life you just write and you're not thinking of anyone else. You're just trying to get through the night. You're just trying to prove to yourself that you're worth something. And then when it becomes your career, you got to start thinking about, like, oh, what's it going to mean? How it's going to play out in a campaign?
So you're not present. It's not present, is it? It's not that state, you know, you're overthinking it. You're playing how it might, you know, what might the single be, what the campaign might be. Yeah,
I wouldn't go that far. I'm not one of them artists, like, because my singles, they don't matter. They don't get playlisted. They don't. So I can still. And also, I'm like a complete fucking narcissist. Like, everything I do is just to make me feel better. And I love that people connect to it.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
I'm in this period of me. So the way writing works for me is 8 months out of the year, it's a nightmare, because it's not coming. At the minute, I'm in a great place with me writing, where I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I've got an idea and I do it. And that's fantastic. Like, I write it, and then the next day I live with it and I think, wow, yeah, like, I might not be Ed Sheeran or Wunderbar or, you know, any of these people, but it's good, you know, and that, God, it means so much, you know. And I wish there was an alternative, I really do. I hate that, like, romantic writer fucking Ian Curtis bullshit thing, but there's a truth to it. You just, like, it saves you, it keeps you fucking going, you know. So that's where I'm at now. So last night, the reason I put this back, it was because at 3 o'clock in the morning I woke up with music. With music in my head. I was like, I've got to put that down. So I had a couple of cigs, I had a decaf coffee, I did some weights, because I'm recently single and, you know, you need to get your tits in order. That's the album title, isn't it? Get your tits in order.
We got it.
I'm going through a very, very hard breakup.
And you just mentioned that, you have these periods of like 8 months, but at the moment the writing is good. And then you've obviously just mentioned you're going through a difficult breakup. Like, are they connected? So do you think that's... She isn't. Okay. So do you think... are they linked? So is it a case that, you know, maybe this is providing some fuel for the writing, that the fact that you've obviously gone through a bit of emotional time? Or is that completely separate?
No, it's absolutely true. And it's like a dichotomy of everything I've said. Like, it's the opposite of everything I've said. Like, the artist who has nothing else, like... But for me, if honestly, if my writing wasn't good right now, I'd just be in the boozer. Like, you know, that's not to say I've given up. I'm working. Like, you will have seen that Instagram post. Two days ago, I walked around a lake that I haven't walked around for 15 years without drugs and without drink. And so I'm working. You know, I want a better life. I don't just want to be someone who... I think songwriting's like a drug, yeah? Like, the high you get from writing something pure and clean will carry you through. You don't need to eat, you don't need to do anything if you've got that one verse. Like, I've just written something today, well, last night, that's just wonderful. And as a result, that'll do me. Like, that'll do me for weeks, actually. I'll be sniffing that fart for a long time. Do you know what I mean?
And when that song comes to you, when you woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, had your cigarettes, did a few weights, is that, are you literally just writing or something, singing into like dictaphone just immediately, or is it a case of like, right, laptop open, Logic open, actually, you know, guitar out, work out what the chords are, whatever it might be, or is it just kind of just a very brief idea that you just want to nail down before it disappears again?
No, I'm very lucky. I don't have perfect pitch, but I wouldn't say I've got perfect intonation, but my intonation, do you know what intonation is?
I know perfect pitch. What's intonation?
Intonation is the relationship between notes. Yeah. So, like, if I hear a piece of music, let's say it's...
Oh, you can work out the what the notes are between them. Right, okay, right.
Yeah, so if you've got, like... Hang on, let's get this piano one. Say if you've got a C, and then you know the fourth up from that is F.
Yeah.
And then the fifth is, you know, you've got the minor sixth. I couldn't go C and sing you a C, but if I hear a song, I go, well, that's one.
Yeah.
That chord is one. And then whatever happens next, I'm usually pretty good at going. So if I hear a song that I love, I'll just remember the numbers, you know. I'll just remember it's a one, it's a four with a minor, and then it's a diminished first inversion of the F minor. Those things I just have, and I'm very lucky to have them, and they help my writing an awful lot, because particularly if it comes to you in night, you know that your subconscious brain's out of the equation, and you're just feeling something that it's not really yours, you know. That's a beautiful thing. Like, it's very, it makes you feel special. And you don't have to have that. I mean, I don't think the Sex Pistols had that. I don't think Joy Division had that. But I think Paul McCartney did. And, you know, it right helps, you know. Yeah.
What about your vocals? Like, so... You've got a really distinctive style, and I just wonder if there's anyone that particularly influenced you as a singer, particularly the intimacy between you and the microphone. It's like you don't project like often, do you? It's like it's really kind of like almost whispering it sometimes. I just wonder if there was anyone, if you've ever kind of listened to anyone and thought, oh, actually, yeah, that kind of shaped me either consciously or subconsciously about how I go about singing.
Nah, I've never seen myself as a singer. I was reticent to do it. This is what I can do. Like, I can speak in tune. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's how I think about it. Like, I can speak in tune, but the reason I think people enjoy my delivery of vocals is I sonically make it so it's the thing that you hear, and I want people to have my voice fucking right there with no reverb, very little compression, just the song, because you can't, like, you know, some of us aren't Frank Sinatra, and sometimes you just... And with me, with the nature of the songs, it makes more sense for me to just talk to people. So no, God, I'd love to sing like Eros Childs or Griff Rhys or Mark Kozelek, or, you know, but I think the thing again, we talked about advice. The main thing, I think, is acknowledging your limitations and making them your strong point, you know. So if I, you know, like, it, you know, if my first record, if I'd have tried to Frank Sinatra that, it would have just completely, like, voided, negated the whole point of the record, you know. So yeah, when I sing, singing's a weird thing. Like, and we'll get into writing actually, because I think this is an interesting thing. Like, writing is, if you're thwarted by a lack of talent for singing, then you look elsewhere. So when I write, 9 times out of 10, I'll write a song on the piano. I'll go, bah, 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 do this. And it's the melody. I get the melody. That's it. And then I'll sit in the bath and then I'll write a song that is clever. Well, you know, I think is clever or personal and introspective and works as a song. And then when I get back to my bedroom, I pick the guitar up and I sing those words. They're too wordy. What I always forget is that the key for me for songwriting is establish a beautiful melody and find words that don't get in the way of that. I think there's exceptions. So Morrissey and Alex Turner have made their style is they give you a melody in the first verse and then they deviate from it. They add syllables that shouldn't be there. Or unnatural, and that's very progressive. I'm the opposite way. Like, I will drop good lyrics to make sure that the melody that I've written isn't imposed on. So, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Given all that, and given how personal it is to you, how do you find in the past? I know you haven't always done this, but when you have had to give your songs over to a producer. Or worked with a producer, and then you know you're giving your baby away a little bit.
I've never worked with a producer.
Even with the Coral.
Yeah, but they weren't my songs.
They weren't your songs, I guess. Yeah. So I guess that dynamic really that isn't going to impact you too much. How would you feel about giving your songs over to a producer if they change them?
Well, that's not fucking happening. Why would I? You know.
Yeah.
Why would I? Yeah. It's not like you know. If someone gave me 200 grand and went go in the studio with this big shot, yeah, I'd take 200 grand and make a shit record because 200 grand's life-changing to me. And I'm very egotistical about my music, but if someone wants to give me a shitload of music, I'll eat the shit sandwich. And if they want to put like a, you know, when bands like, you know, like Cortinas or whatever, or like, when they hit that rock and they have to go like, oh, we've got to go electro now. That's the only avenue for indie rock. That's the only next step. Yeah, I'd eat that up. I'd hate myself forever, but buy a house with it and I reckon I could get over it. But no, I only work with people like, the people I've worked with, the only person who's ever produced me as on a record was James Ford.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oxy Monkeys guy, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Jay was amazing. Like, I learned so much from him.
What specifically did you learn that you now put into your kind of practice when you're writing or producing your own stuff?
Calm. You know, it's calm. The whole process is so charged. If you're writing songs, it's not just the songs. The songs, your sense of self, how you understand yourself. And working with Jay, all he did was go, you're fucking amazing. Could we do this? You know what I mean? And working with him, the record I did with him, we actually scrapped because I need to make my own records. Like, there's no point. There's just no point in anyone else being involved in what I do. Probably my career could have done better if I'd taken one of those opportunities, but like, I don't make enough money from this to, and I don't have any desire to be any bigger than I am, so I just do it myself, you know, and I think it works, you know.
Do you think there's a risk, though, that you if you're surrounded, because I know once you said, like, a lot of the bands you played with live are kind of your mates and stuff, that you end up just being surrounded by yes men or yes people, and, like, who's your critical friend? Who's the person who can go, do you know what, Bill, that could do with a tweak or anything like that? Or is that just you trust your own judgment, which would be completely legitimate because your stuff's perfect and beautiful as it is. But just out of interest, like, have you got that kind of critical friend or that someone who can give you feedback? Or
I have a few people that I run things past, and if they give me the wrong answer, then I won't speak to them. So there's three people I can think of. Well, four people I can think of. Liam Power, who's in By the Sea, who's my guitarist. Me, we're soulmates, brothers, you know. He says everything I do could be massive. That's his thing. This could be massive. So I have to be careful of him. I go to Carl Roberts, who's a doctor. He's incredibly talented, like his songwriting. One of my favourite songs, Ginty's song called Now I Know, I think it's still one of the most perfect songs I've ever heard. I run stuff by him. This whole album, my ex-girlfriend, Larissa, was very... She really dictated where it went. Like, I'd show her stuff, she'd go, nah. And I trusted her enough to go, okay, fuck that. And if I did something she liked, then we'd carry it through. And then there's my manager, Ellie Giles, who about 2 years ago learned that constructive criticism is something that this only child is not particularly interested in. So those four people know to just tell me I'm great. And
that's sometimes all we need to hear.
Join the conversation at facebook.com/StageLeftPodcast, where we discuss the thoughts from our guests, including Stuart Lee, Steve Cropper, Miles Copeland III, Tony Visconti, Gail, and Bill.
So here's a question I think a lot of listeners would love to know. You know, when I told people I know that I was interviewing you today, two separate people came back to me who I respect greatly, and both said you were a genius on guitar. Use that word, independent of each other, genius on guitar. I mean, fans of your solo stuff also, actually. One's a super fan. But yeah, genius on guitar. And when you went solo, you kind of divorced yourself from the guitar a little bit, certainly initially, and it's kind of a little bit more back in there, but it's obviously very piano-based. Who influenced you as a guitarist growing up? Was there anyone who shaped your particular... You know, it was Ian Brody who said how unique you are as a guitarist as well. Like, where did that come from? What shaped that? Was there a particular guitarist that you were trying to emulate or inspired you, or did you have lessons? Like, what's your journey with that guitar so you got to that place of genius?
I love that question, because the people that did that didn't just shape me as a guitarist, they shaped me as a person. So Nick McCabe from The Verve.
Yeah.
The fact that Richard Ashcroft was always... And Nick McCabe just had his head down and did his stuff, you know. Will Sargent from the Bunnymen, and Michael Caroli from Cannes. Who am I missing? Who am I missing? John Ed from Shach. Lee Southall from The Coral. It's an amazing guitarist. Seriously fucking original in a way I wasn't original. Dave Gilmour. Like, melodic players. Players who didn't... Because I'm a producer now, so when I work with bands, like, if it ain't the drummer, it's the fucking guitarist. And the amount of times you have to say to the guitarist, like, mate, what you're doing, I get that you're into it, but are you aware that the singer's singing? If he's singing, shut the fuck up. Don't do anything when he's singing, just stay out of the way. When he stops singing, step in, you know. But Graham Coxon, you know. Yeah, people who danced around the song, added to the song, you know, that was... And that's actually followed me through, even with the orchestration and all the other things I do, that lesson, and that was when I was 16. You know what you're like when you're 16, you know? You're not sure who you are or whatever. And then Nick McCabe turned up, and he was the one. He changed my understanding of your role in a band, which is really important, you know, to be a part that adds to the collective, you know. I don't hear that a lot these days, you know. A lot of the bands I work with, you have a drummer who's just into drums, you have a guitar who's just into guitar. Bass players usually couldn't give a shit. They just want to play the bass. And then you've got your singer who's, it's his baby and they're his songs. So telling drummers, and honestly, most of my professional life in the studio is telling drummers and guitarists, like, mate, no one gives a fuck what you're doing. Like, just stay out of the way. You'll have your minute. Just shut the fuck up for 3 minutes. All you have to do is be quiet for 2 minutes, you know. But yeah, those people, Nick McCabe would be my one, you know. And
nice.
He actually sent me a message. It's one of the highlights of my life. He messaged me on Twitter saying, I was at home and BBC, and it was Radio 6, had played Mither, a song of mine, and he said he ran upstairs or downstairs to hear it. And I was like, it's Nick McCabe, like, he's the one, like, he's it, you know.
Do you see yourself ever in alongside your solo career, joining different bands and being the guitarist who just kind of is head down in the corner and playing, and you know, because, you know, it's you're so good on the guitar, and obviously, you know, it's almost a bit of a waste, you know, what a waste of a genius, a waste of a talent, if it isn't front and centre in what you do so as your solo career. And that's, and it's not, it's very obviously piano and orchestral led, and there is obviously guitar in there. Could you ever see yourself in another band doing just guitar?
Oh, I'd love that. Noel Gallagher calls me up and goes, you want to go on tour for 3 months? And it's 350 quid a day to play guitar. I play guitar for Brook Bentham every now and then.
Mm.
Just not having to sing and just fucking putting my head down and playing with my effects. I love it. I'd do more of it. Like, you know, I love... Johnny Marr did it with Modest Mouse and a few, you know. Yeah, I'd absolutely do that. You know, with the right band, I'd love that. You know, not sing, not write.
So would you do that with Noel, or is that just not something you want to do at the moment, or is that something that could happen?
No, well, it wouldn't happen because he's got a set band. But my point was, like, if
it did happen, right.
Yeah, it's something more realistic. If it, well, like, I was with Griff Rhys not long ago, and we did a gig in London, and I was like, "Oh, what are you doing after this?" And he was like, "We're going to Dublin. Do you want to?" Griff's very like that. Oh, do you want to come? Like, oh man, I want to fucking come. So. I want to come and play so much. Like, I'd love to do that. Yeah, absolutely. If someone like that asked me to join the band and I could, like, financially do it, no bother. I don't have any ego about that. Like, in fact, it's something that I'm proud. One thing that you got from the choral, this is the thing that choral are, like, unsung with, is Jay used to come in with a song, and it was just understood that you had to learn it now, you know? You just had to get it. You had to get it in half an hour. And that's something that stood us in good stead. So anytime if I'm working with a band and they need guitar, I've got that in the locker, you know? I know I can just do guitar. And like, it's a bit... I was speaking to a friend of mine who's like an actor, and I was like, how'd you learn all the lines? And he was like, I'll be honest with you, like, it's weirdly offensive to actors because learning the lines is the easy bit. Mm-hmm. And I think guitar's the same. It's like, it's the easy bit. Like, if someone wants to call me up and give me some money just to be great at guitar, I'd just be so fucking easy, you know, compared to writing, you know.
So that was part one of two with Bill Ryder-Jones. We've got another episode, the rest of the interview coming out later this week, where he discusses his time with the Arctic Monkeys. But if you've enjoyed what you've heard so far, let us know at the Stage F Pod on Twitter, Instagram at the Stage F Podcast, and facebook.com/the Stage F Podcast. And check out the new episode, which is coming out in the next few days. Cheers.